If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I was stunned to see that the Churchill that I thought I knew, the Churchill that we inherit, really, was a man who changed his position on a critical issue of peace with Hitler by the day and sometimes by the hour.
That was Anthony McCartan discussing Winston Churchill's darkest hour.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the first History Extra podcast of 2018. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, we're telling the story behind the latest historical blockbuster, Darkest Hour, with the film's writer, Anthony McCartan. He caught up a little while ago with our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
So we're here in Penguin's offices in London with screenwriter and novelist Anthony McCartan. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, good morning.
Morning. So your book, Darkest Hour, How Churchill Brought Us Back from the Brink, is out now, and it considers a crucial moment in Winston Churchill's leadership, a series of meetings in May 1940, during which Churchill's war cabinet considered a possible peace deal with Hitler. Churchill is often portrayed as this immovable, pugnacious character that was kind of immune to pressures, though you explore the hesitation that may have affected him during as this peace deal was considered. So what drew you to this portrayal and particularly this series of events in his career?
Well, my journey to dealing with this specific subject was quite circuitous and quite stretched over a long time frame. I first became aware probably about 10 years ago, because I'm a sucker for a great speech. And on my bookshelves, I invariably have two or three books that variously titled Great Speeches That Change the World. It's a questionable feat whether a great speech can actually change the world. But I believe it can when it's the right words alloyed to the right idea and delivered by the right person. So in these books, anyway, you would always find at least one speech by Winston Churchill, and often two or three. And around this time, after a little bit more research, I found that three of his real doozies had been written and delivered within a four-week period. And that was an extraordinary feat of pure writing, really, and delivery. And it begged the question, what sort of forces had spurred him to rise to these magnificent heights of rhetoric? And a little bit more inquiry at that point revealed that, well, we were at war. Britain was at war. The states of Central and Western Europe were collapsing by the hour. And it looked like invasion of Britain was not only imminent, but possibly a day or two away. So there were these incredible pressures on him. And then I dived into, and it was amazing to me that this is available at your own desk, but you can dive into the minutes of those meetings in the War Cabinet via the National Archives. And there in little PDFs are the Secretary's record of who said what during those incredibly perilous days in May 1940. And I was stunned to see that the Churchill that I thought I knew, that the Churchill that we inherit, really, was a man who changed his position on a critical issue of peace with Hitler by the day and sometimes by the hour. And I was not of one mind at all. I went in completely open-minded. But the facts started to pile up that not only did Churchill consider a peace deal with his arch enemy, this homicidal maniac Adolf Hitler, but he actually took steps towards it, the first tentative steps towards it, in the form of drafting a memorandum to the Italian ambassador, Bastianini, to investigate the possibility of Italy being a peace broker between Britain and Nazi Germany. When I discovered that, I thought, wow, kind of eureka. Who knew? This is a really interesting new take on this man. And it fed into a belief that's sort of been percolating away in me since I was an undergraduate, that one of the great perils in society is leaders whose minds are always made up. Leaders who aren't able to tolerate an opposite opinion and snuff it out. And I've always thought that our destiny is secured by people with an open mind. And we especially need that in our leaders. So to find evidence that Churchill, the great warrior, the great firebrand who brooked no doubt and was always just had one word in his mind, charge, was not in evidence in these historical records, was really exciting to me and reassuring. And rather than diminish him in my eyes, it elevated him, because this image of a man who was uncertain, who looked into the unthinkable, which was this peace deal with Hitler, who weighed that idea seriously, and then synthesized opposing positions and finally came to a decision, seemed to me not only evidence of his genius, but also of the qualities that we should look for in our leaders.
So the proposition of peace at this time, could you perhaps talk a little bit about what this proposition was, who the advocates were in the War Cabinet, and how Churchill had the sense to listen to them and have this open mind about what they faced, and how he dealt with these people?
Well, there was an argument that was being formed within this War Cabinet. Now, let's do a little bit of history here. So Winston was an unwanted kind of political figure. He's not the man we know today. And on the 9th of May 1940, when it looked like Chamberlain was going to fall and the search was on for a new leader, Winston Churchill was pretty far down on the list. If he was known for anything, he was known for overseeing disasters. There'd been Gallipoli, there'd been the gold standard, his failed India policy, all manner of disasters. In fact, a few weeks before, there'd been a horrific situation in Norway with an invasion by the British Navy that ended up in catastrophic loss of ships and men. And so when they were casting about for a new leader, I mean, Winston was an imponderable, like, oh my God, anyone but Winston. However, in the shaping of a unity government, the Labour Party insisted on the only candidate they would accept was Winston Churchill. So the Conservative government, of whom Winston was a figure, he was the Lord of the Admiralty at that point, went to Winston and knocked on his door. And after a bit of debate and a question about whether it should be Lord Halifax or Winston, and there was an enormous amount of support for Halifax. Halifax was very close to the king. He was Chamberlain's choice. Halifax may even have been Halifax's choice. But after a very testing kind of meeting in Chamberlain's room, where Winston famously stayed silent, when asked, did he see any reason why Lord Halifax, as a lord from the House of Lords, might not be made head of the House of Representatives and become Prime Minister. Winston stayed silent, and Halifax's desire to push for the premiership apparently collapsed, and he endorsed Churchill. So Churchill ends up PM on May 10th, 1940, and everybody's anticipating more of the same. Hot-blooded, spur-of-the-moment decisions. As Roosevelt said of Churchill, about 98% of his ideas are absolute rubbish and dangerous, but 2% are brilliant. And he starts assembling this war cabinet. Well, because it's a unity government, he has to people it with not only his supporters, but his rivals. So he puts Lord Halifax in there, and Chamberlain, of course, and members of the representatives of the other parties, the Liberal and the Labour parties. So this is a very ununified representation of a unity government. And the two factions sort of started to find themselves in that. And they were those headed by Halifax, who supported the idea that at this dark, dark moment in British history and in European history and world history, it only made sense to consider the idea of a peace deal. Why? Because the biggest army the world had ever seen was overrunning Western Europe at will. Britain was in full retreat, heading towards Dunkirk, where they were quickly surrounded and looked like being on the verge of being annihilated. That would have left Britain completely defenseless, except for an amateur army or, you know, dad's army type defense. And in those circumstances, the moral argument that was being made by Halifax was the only argument that had any held any sway. In both the movie and the book, I hope I capture the sense that Halifax is not an antagonist in this story. He is, in fact, making the moral argument you pray that anyone would make in that situation. For God's sake, you know, it had not been that many years since the horrifying numbers of deaths since World War I. Surely we must strain every sinew to find a peaceful way out of this. And Halifax, who was a highly moral man, steeped in the High Church of England, a great patriot, was not talking peace deal out of any weakness of character. He was expressing his views powerfully, passionately, out of his love of country. And he saw it as the only way to save the country. What he didn't see, and what Winston was able to perceive, because he was such a fantastic student of history, was that here was a tyrant. And you cannot deal with tyrants, as he said, and we have a beautiful scene in the movie performed by Gary Oldman as Winston, where he shouts, "You cannot argue with a tiger when your head is in its mouth." And he saw Hitler for what he was, a person with whom you could not negotiate. And yet, as the days passed, as we get into late May, the facts on the ground worsened by the hour. Every new military dispatch was another disaster. The annihilation of the British troops, the British Expeditionary Force, there was no way to avoid the fact that it seemed inevitable. that the entire force of some 350,000 men would be wiped out. Halifax then stepped in and said, "Winston, if you won't consider peace talks, I'm prepared to resign." And Winston, who knew the moral conviction behind that resignation, it wasn't a tactic. It was done out of full conviction and belief on Halifax's part. That seemed to be a tipping point in the debate. And Winston thought, if men such as Halifax are prepared to step down and walk away at this moment, perhaps I'm wrong. And that was the seed of the entire drama for me. So I decided to do a movie and then subsequently a book because of really that moment, the ability of someone to think, maybe I'm wrong. There's a great quote, which I probably won't quote correctly, of Oliver Cromwell writing to the Archbishop in Edinburgh centuries ago, and he said, I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think that you may be wrong. And it's an extraordinary comment. Think it possible you may be wrong. I think that is absolutely a prerequisite for great leadership. And Winston proved himself in that moment capable of thinking that he was wrong.
When you began considering the National Archives, the other sources that you considered, what were you hoping to find? And were you surprised by the indecision that you found?
Yeah, utterly. I hadn't suspected it. You go in and you think, okay, I think I know who this guy is. And the most delightful thing as a researcher is when you find contradictions to that perception, and that perception shatters. But what emerges is someone far more interesting because he's more dimensional, and dimensionality is what you're looking for as a writer. He was much more believable, and it was really creatively a kind of rubbing your hands together and going, "This is terrific! This is great! I know exactly what I can do, and I know more importantly why this story needs to be told." Why it's really important and useful, if I can pull it off. And not only me, but everybody then who would join in the making of the film and so forth, the director and the actors and so forth. And so we formed a wonderful team, and everybody who read the script was convinced that this was worth doing, and we were somehow bringing news, which is very important when you're trying to form your own little army. Everybody wants to know why we're doing it and why so much money is being spent on this endeavor. And if you say, well, you know, at the heart of it, there's something really interesting and maybe even valuable in this exercise. And it makes it easier to recruit people and easier to convince. So the film rapidly came together and you know, the fruits are now going to be soon viewable by everybody, and we'll see what the great public make of it.
Why then do you believe that this this commonly held view of him as this stubborn, stoic character, kind of charging Britain forward at this crucial time, has surpassed then this more nuanced, sometimes indecisive character that you've explored in the book?
I think it's because I'm a New Zealander and I'm coming and telling your British stories and looking afresh at your own iconography. No, I don't really know. Perhaps it was necessary to have this image of him. And perhaps he did quite a good job of creating that impression himself. Certainly his own record of the Second World War, he doesn't spend more than a couple of sentences on this period of the peace deal with Hitler. He kind of brushes over it. So he was not averse to being a myth maker about his own career. And he knew what the Churchill brand was, and he was a master at it. You know, he never went anywhere without that cigar. He ended up stopping smoking them all, but he always used to have one because he knew it was the image. So He was the architect of that myth, probably the initial architect of it. But then Britain, as its international influence declined, probably wanted the Mount Rushmore figure, the invincible leader, the warrior, and it just has lain like that for decades. I'm not making any great claims for my portrait of him being completely revisionist or anything like that. But I am making a claim that it is, from all the research I did and the researchers who worked on the film and helped me with the book, is that we got it right. We really found the available information, and we let the facts speak for themselves.
So to see Winston Churchill as this singularly minded, stubborn figure that some people might regard him as today, do you believe that's to do him a disservice?
Yeah, so- I do, for the reasons I've sort of spoken. Yeah, anyone who's only in conversation with himself, which is probably the definition of a mind made up, is not doing us a service. And an open mind is what we require. It's what we dearly need. And he proved himself to be open-minded. Pedestals, they're for statues. And we have mythologized Winston Churchill. There are sides to him, and certainly in the movies I've seen of him and many of the books, and certainly in the public imagination. You see him down in just in Westminster with that famous statue. His shoulders are hunched, as if he's leaning forward, as if pushing into a stiff wind, and he's marching forward and so forth. But I never believed that. Every human being's capable of doubt. They must be if they're human. Only a madman is incapable of that, and perhaps Hitler never brooked any doubt. But we know what sort of leader he was. But no, I spent most of my time on both movie and book looking for other elements to his character that have not seen the light of day, really. I wanted to show his romanticism, his tenderness with Clemmy, who was the great love of his life. And his love for her never wavered, nor hers for him. And they went through tough times, and they were difficult people. He must have been a nightmare to be married to. But she was also very, very highly strung. She needed electroshock therapy to treat her depression later in life. So she knew about the black dog as well. And I wanted to show his tenderness and his romanticism, and the way that he could employ his words to weave a spell for her too, not as a Don Juan or anything, but as a tender man, because the public image of Churchill is more that he was born in a bad mood smoking a cigar. So as far away from that as I could get, I wanted to try and achieve. And secondly, I wanted to show his wit. Any quick reading of the man's output of witticisms and epigrams shows an incredibly witty man. And it wasn't just dinner table wit, which was easily dispensed. He deployed wit strategically, often in the political realm too, where he knew that that tense situations or positions of where people were very, very entrenched in their positions, you could break down those walls with humour. And he was famous for doing that. So in my dramatization of certain scenes, when people seemed impossibly at odds and were barking at each other, he would raise his voice even higher than them. But instead of some vehement statement or aggressive threat, out would come a joke. And boy, I wish I had that facility. So yes, wit. I think he said somewhere that one cannot understand the most serious things in life unless one understands the most humorous. So he saw the relationship of humor and seriousness, and he saw the threat of seriousness, that if we approach all human problems only with utmost seriousness, we're in trouble. Humor has a a real role to play in negotiating our way through any crisis.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
And in your book, in your account, in your screenplay, something that you explore very thoroughly is Winston Churchill's key skill for rhetoric, for his speechmaking. Mm. What did you find out during your research about the way in which he put his speeches together, the way in which he presented them?
He was a tremendous student of rhetoric. I mean, I love Winston Churchill for a lot of reasons. One is his admiration for him as a writer. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And in fact, when he died, he'd actually published more words than Shakespeare and Charles Dickens combined. So just absolutely heroic levels of production as a writer. But since an early age, he'd been a student of speeches. He'd been fascinated by the power of words to galvanize in the hearts of a people a shared locus of feeling. And if you could create that shared feeling in a people and unify them, then the unthinkable could become thinkable. So he read the Greeks, he read the Romans, he'd read Cicero. He was a guy who, for light summer reading, would read the 27 volumes of parliamentary debate called the Annual Register. And what he was looking for was words that would move, words that would create trust in a public for a leader. And then you could move them into a position that they had not known that they would go. My feeling is that in order to be influential, you must be willing to be influenced. And he was heavily influenced by his scholarship and his study. I'll just read you something here that I thought was very revealing. Winston, when he was young, before and early in his parliamentary career, actually wrote an essay called The Scaffolding of Rhetoric. And in it, he expressed his thoughts about the power of great oratory. And he kind of defined great oratory as a clever trick, which sounds a bit cynical. But if the ends justify the means, then he was all for it. And he talked about fooling the audience with a, quote, a series of vivid impressions, which are replaced before they can be too closely examined. and vanish before they can be assailed. So it's essentially the audience is left with an emotion that may not be quite, and they may not be quite sure how they came by it, and may not be inclined to understand why. And I guess we ask ourselves, how often in history have the public been so beguiled by speakers? Well, he wanted to have that magic. He wanted to be able to wield that piece of sorcery and be able to take it to a public at the right moment and sway them and turn them. My sense, my belief is that all leaders need luck, and the luck that they need is times commensurate with their talents. And in May 1940, Winston had that luck, and we were lucky enough that he was lucky, because he came in with really the only thing that Britain had in that hour was words. But I guess the lesson is, if you are left to fight with only one thing, you could do a lot worse than words.
Another aspect of Churchill's figure that you explore in your account is his premiership style. And there might be some perhaps unexpected factors that you explore in your account, such as his naps. Could you perhaps talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Oh, he took naps in the afternoon. And he said, you don't miss a bout with a nap. You have to strip off, go completely naked, hop into bed, take it seriously, get a proper good couple of hours. And then he said, you'll have 2 days instead of one. And then he would work very late, sometimes to 2 or 3 in the morning, much to the chagrin of his staff, who would be asked, who weren't taking naps in the afternoon, who would be asked to stay up with him, you know, past the midnight hour, hear the chimes of midnight. So he was a taskmaster, but eccentric as all hell. I mean, he would start the day with a scotch and soda on his breakfast tray beside the bacon and eggs. During the war, when milk became unavailable and he hated condensed milk in his tea, so he said, to hell with it, give me a glass of white wine in addition to the scotch and soda on the breakfast tray. So this wouldn't be tolerated today if the Daily Express found out that Theresa May was having a glass of white wine and a scotch and soda on a breakfast tray. She would be ushered out of power immediately. But, you know, he wasn't finished there. He had a bottle of Paul Roger champagne at lunch, and then another with his evening meal, followed by port and so forth. So, by modern standards, he was a functioning alcoholic. But, you know, when you're a genius, which he undoubtedly was, you can get away with murder. And people adored him, even the ones he gave a tough time to, and his secretaries will attest to his moods and his tempers and so forth, but they all fell under his sway and knew that they were assisting and abetting a genius.
And in your book, you find a particularly kind of cheeky account where Winston Churchill records of his first meeting with King George VI when he's about to be asked to form a government. Mm. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that and perhaps the King's reservations at this stage as well.
Yes, well, like all PMs, he was called to the palace and asked to form a government, and he shows up and the King apparently said, Mr. Churchill, I assume I won't do the stutter. I suspect you know why I have summoned you here. And to which Churchill replied, Your Majesty, I simply have no idea. So that was that moment had to be recreated, and delightfully done. But we know from diaries, the King's diary, that he was not in favour of Winston at the beginning. There was quite a terse atmosphere between the two of them. The King, as I said earlier, favoured Halifax. Halifax was the only member of government who the King had given a personal key to so that he could shorten his walk to Parliament and he could cut through Buckingham Palace. So he had a key to the garden gate. So, yes, they were very close, Halifax and the King. But it was Winston with whom the King would have to deal. And pressing on the King, apart from everything else, was the question of whether he should be moved to Canada and whether he should take his family and somehow rule in exile or, escape for the fray. So he wanted Winston's opinion on those kind of matters. But they began to spend time together. They had to have an audience with each other once a week. And during those meetings, and when the king saw the brilliant gifts that Winston produced, he was quickly swayed and turned in his opinion of Winston. And his diaries within 4 months of Winston becoming PM show a real warming towards Winston. And by the end of the war, it's said to be one of the closest relationships ever enjoyed by a PM and a king. So they became firm friends and colleagues and collaborators, and the king was a vital support to Winston as the war went on, and vice versa.
So the film of your screenplay is out later this year, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. And you wrote in a piece for History Extra last month that we've seen more ink expended on Churchill than on any other figure in history. Why then do you believe it's so valuable to reconsider him in this year, in 2017?
I think he's the greatest Briton that ever lived. He was great when we needed someone to be great. He wasn't great across the vast expanse of his career. He was kind of a sub Boris Johnson for much of his. Forgive me, Mr. Johnson, for impugning you in that way. But even Boris would admit he's a spontaneous character. He says a lot of stuff for effect, but he's undoubtedly smart as well. And Boris and Winston are both sort of historians. I really love Boris's book on Winston. I thought it was tremendous. But Winston as a figure in these times is clearly a kind of beacon of candor or something. I'm straining here a little bit to get at what I'm feeling, but there's something about Winston that was incapable of intrigue and deceit, and that's why the public really loved him. I think if there was one thing apart from the words and the stirring speeches, it would be the fact that he leveled with them. He gave it to them as it was, unvarnished, and that was often at his own cost. I mean, it's not easy to be told, I imagine, when you're huddled around a radio in 1940, that, you know, we will fight until we lie upon the ground choking in our own blood, or that victory at all costs, no matter what the cost. We will fight them here, we will fight them in your homes, we'll fight them in your living rooms, on the landing grounds, we will be fighting them in your schools, we'll be... you know, wherever you can consider your intimate space, you will be asked to fight for your survival. This was really shocking news. He wasn't varnishing, he wasn't dressing it up, and he gave it to them straight, and so that they could make their own frank evaluation of whether they would support him. Were they up for it? And they decided in vast numbers that they did. And I think that most lovable quality of his, this candor, this tell it how it is what we miss these days. There's tremendous distrust in our leaders, and a leader now says, I've just been in America, and they have this awful phrase, to walk something back, walk a statement back. I think Reagan coined the phrase, oh, I misspoke. Well, that's another awful sort of paraphrasing of the word lie. You mean you lied. Donald Trump is saying something, and then the next moment they say, oh, he rode back on that statement, or he walked back on that statement. Well, then you've just done injury to language, and you've done injury to political discourse, and you've done injury to what we want from a leader, which is candor. Winston never walked anything back. And the reason he didn't was he didn't have to, because he told it straight the first time.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to us about your account, Anthony. The book is out now. It's Darkest Hour, How Churchill Brought Us Back from the Brink. And the film Darkest Hour is out on general release later this year. So thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.
So that was Anthony McCartan talking to Eleanor Evans. Darkest Hour is already on release in several countries around the world and will be in UK cinemas from the 12th of January. And if you'd like to read more on this subject, then look out for our January issue, which goes on sale later this week and contains a piece on Churchill's struggle to keep Britain in the war. Meanwhile, you can also read a piece by Anthony McCartan about Churchill on our website. Head to historyextra.com/Churchill at war for that. And Anthony has written a book that accompanies the film, which is also entitled Darkest Hour. It's available now, published by Viking in the UK and Harper Perennial in the US. OK, so that's about it for today, but please do listen in again on Thursday when we'll be talking to Ron Chernow about Alexander Hamilton.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.
Black voices are making an impact this month and beyond. Keep listening to discover one of our favorite shows, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
There's a lot of misinformation out there, but the truth remains indisputable. I'm Dr. Rashad Ritchie, and every day I'll be bringing you a full dose of truth on my show, Indisputable. We cover criminal justice, social justice, politics, racism, police brutality, and everything in between. I even make space for conservative voices, but not before they step into the bullpen, where I debate them on their policy agenda. In January, I hosted They Called Him Radical, a special tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It features myself, Senator Nina Turner, Ricky Smiley, and Sharon Reed. Together, we reflected on Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy, his real legacy, and considered what we can all do to continue to fight for a better world. Listen to Indisputable and They Called Him Radical on Apple Podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.